TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. David Keith, A Case for Climate Engineering. This is the second half of an hour with Harvard climate scientist David Keith, author of the book A Case for Climate Engineering. He says global warming and CO2 pollution have become so severe that dramatic measures to cool the earth have to be applied by 2020. He's suggesting spraying sulfuric acid from airplanes into the stratosphere. He admits that such global intervention will damage the ozone layer, cause droughts and floods, and will do nothing to resolve the expanding damage from still rising CO2 emissions. In part one, he explained how inexpensive the process is. Using commercial business jets from any airfield long enough for takeoff and landing. He denies that spraying from airplanes has already begun and warns that this form of solar radiation management has the power to suddenly change the Earth's climate. The impacts, he says, will be different from country to country and north to south. They can lead to war when some countries engineer the climate in their favor and send droughts and floods elsewhere. Coming up in this program are questions and answers. Could Exxon or the Koch brothers just do it? Can it be done surreptitiously? His answer to that is yes. And a young man working on solar power said he felt scared that all the emerging technologies creating energy from the sun would be condemned to fail. This and more is written up in David Keith's book, A Case for Climate Engineering, published in October 2013 at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The Boston Review gave the book a release event that was videotaped, and the audio for this radio program comes from their website. MIT political scientist Kenneth Oyer opens the Q&A session.
Let me ask the first question, then we'll ask everybody here to pitch in with their own. Moving past the question of should we do research, which I think you're very persuasive on that of course we should do research on this. Going back to the fundamental, first order question of how would that research be set up, a key question it would address is how dangerous are the solutions, the various solutions that are on the menu? What risks do they pose? A two-part question. One is, how would you design research programs to evaluate the risks of the various climate engineering solutions that you came up with? This is a sort of methodological question.
Yeah.
How do we measure the risk of proposed, shall we say, grand-scale engineering projects which affect large systems? What's the methodology for that? And we're particularly interested in the most difficult measurement problems, which is how do we measure risks that will be delayed, because they're the most dangerous kind, right? How do we measure risks that are, in fact, inherently unforeseeable? How do you, if you will, to use Donald Rumsfeld's phrase, divine the unknown unknowns? And how do you estimate the degree to which you have divined the unknown unknowns? Second is, I wondered if you could talk to us about what is the history here of grand engineering projects that affect big systems. I think many people react to climate engineering by saying, no, wait a minute, the examples that come to mind are of instances where the consequences of grand projects turned out to be unforeseen, but also hard to mitigate and hard to reverse. The carbon energy complex itself is an example of that. The idea that digging coal out of the ground and burning oil would affect the climate didn't become talked about until we were 100 years into the coal age, I think, and didn't become widely talked about until the 50s. You have that article.
That's sort of interesting. The science has changed much more slowly than people's thinking about it. So Arrhenius was the one who first really understood the basic fact that increasing CO2 would warm the climate, and he published it in 1896. And he got actually the right number, partly by luck, but he had the core physics, actually. It wasn't just luck. There's a nice little anecdote I like to tell. He did these like latitude by latitude calculations all by hand, and I've got students to repeat by spreadsheets, and apparently he was getting a divorce at the time, and he may have needed to be be distracted. Anyhow, he got about the right number. But the real punchline in terms of politics is that while he had about the right scientific answer about what happens when you double CO2 in the atmosphere in terms of the warming, people's views about it were utterly different. This is a guy who lived in Sweden. Okay. And Ekholm, writing at about the same time, suggested that we dig up coal mines, mine coal at the surface and just burn it in order to, so there'd be a virtuous circle, that coal mining would drive the northern limits of agriculture northwards so we could feed a growing population in a kind of virtuous circle. So completely different interpretation about what the right answer was, but actually about the same underlying science. I mean, the ultimate answer about unknowns is that you don't know. There's not much to say that I can easily say about methodology for the really big ones. I think what I can say is there's a trade-off between how new or artificial the technology is and what the unknown unknowns are. So just taking this idea of putting particles in the stratosphere, the thing that I've talked about the most is putting sulfuric acid particles in the stratosphere. The advantage of that is nature does it. And so we have some really solid empirical knowledge that says it can't be too bad. So in the particular scenario I outlined in this book, where we would ramp up starting at zero to about 1 million tons of sulfur a year and then ramp down. So if you don't have experience with this, you don't know whether a million is a big or a small number. But so first of all, we put about 50 million tons a year into the lower atmosphere, and that kills about a million people a year. And so myself and Steve Barrett here, he's been leading the effort at MIT, is actually trying to calculate the air pollution consequences of the stuff we put in, because people would die. And I think that those are different moral deaths, something actually my editor helped to point out in the book wisely, because they come from a deliberate act, not from inaction of putting inadequate pollution controls on. But the key punchline is the following. A big volcano like Pinatubo put 8 million tons in 1 year. And it did deplete the ozone layer, and it did have a bunch of consequences. Right. But on the other hand, it didn't have horrific consequences. And we can observe it. And so if you have had nature put in 8, you have good reason to think that putting in 1 a year is not going to produce some wild unknown unknown. You can never rule it out. But you have some good empirical, not just theory, but observations. Whereas I have proposed, and some other people have too, actually, some other people called Ed Teller and others, have proposed some very clever bits of physics that are advanced kinds of, in my case, I proposed some levitating particles that in principle would be better than sulfates and that they wouldn't destroy ozone and they have various other technical advantages. On the other hand, they wouldn't be something nature has tried. And so I think there's a general trade-off there. I'm not trying to overdo the piece of science I did, but sulfur is sort of the devil we know. We know there are risks. On the other hand, I think the chance of real unknown unknowns with sulfates are pretty small because of nature. These more advanced nanoparticles might be much cleaner, in a sense, cleaner way to alter the amount of sunlight the Earth absorbs than sulfur. But on the other hand, nobody's ever done it before, and the potential for unexpected is clearly larger. So I think that's a trade-off, not necessarily risk assessment, but I think that's not uncommon. I guess one last thing, to answer your question about how big engineering projects, what's their history? If you stop putting sulfur in the atmosphere, it goes out after a year or two. That's not to say all effects go away. But it won't just keep going. Whereas if you introduce a free-living organism or some potentially genetic modified organisms with free-living genes, there is some potential that some little release will actually alter the whole world. And that has, I'll stop at this last comment, that actually has a real big implications for how we think about the research management problem. So we held, I was involved in holding a meeting at Asilomar, California, how we should manage research on this technology. This is one of the big public meetings on this a few years ago. That was held at Asilomar because there had been a very famous meeting held at Asilomar in, maybe you're going to remember the date, early 70s. The community of people doing what at that time they called recombinant DNA technology, figuring out how to self-regulate. And it was a very important meeting in that world. And I think the analogy is actually profoundly wrong. Because with recombinant DNA technology, there is some chance, we can argue about how big it is, but there's some chance that a little laboratory experiment actually could affect the whole world. You know, you make, you know, airborne Ebola. I'd say that there's many reasons why the experiment that Jim Anderson and I are proposing to do might be bad, because it will get people to think differently, or it will lead in a slippery slope to us doing this. And I've been in the last couple of days debating Clive Hamilton, who makes that case very strongly. It's not a dumb case. But I think no rational person argues that our actual experiment is dangerous. We're putting in less sulfur than 1 minute of flight of a regular aircraft in the stratosphere. So it's really, I think, extremely hard to argue that itself has a unique danger. And in that sense, I think the way you think about what the regulatory problems are is different. It's not the direct risks, it's the kind of social consequence risks.
You're really talking about conducting an experiment on a planetary scale, admittedly phased in. On the other hand, we are conducting an experiment on a planetary scale with CO2 emissions with possible irreversible harms right now.
Exactly. So I think those are completely fair comments, and I think you can make reasoned arguments in both directions. So one argument would be to say, I don't think what we're conducting is an experiment, first of all. It's common to say that, but I don't think it's an experiment. I think it's garbage. I think it's really important to say. I mean, so what we're doing right now is the intended effect of our energy system is to provide us all the stuff we like, illumination and computation and transportation. And a side effect of the energy system that isn't what it's engineered to do is changing the climate by putting CO2 from the Earth's crust into the atmosphere. And so I think it's actually quite not helpful to think about that as an experiment. This would be an experiment. It would be a planetary experiment. It would be one that you can't get out of. You've only got one planet with profound consequences. But whether it makes it, the question is, you're not doing that experiment in a neutral world. The question is whether it makes it more or less risky.
Why don't we collect some questions and comments over there? And also, we'd love it if you would tell us your name.
Hi, Kathy Buckley. Thanks for a great discussion. And getting back to unilateral, other than the fact that it's perhaps illegal, immoral, unethical, could some private entities such as Exxon or Koch Brothers or multi-billionaires just do it?
I don't think so. And I think that's actually pretty simple. We've thought through these scenarios. Let me give you sort of two scenarios. So if, and all people often say, because Bill Gates has funded us, could Bill Gates do it? I think the answer is other nations would very quickly assert, probably they could do it privately, that we regard any action by an individual in your nation as an act by that nation. So if, you know, the Koch brothers decide to do it, let's say, the European Union, China, et cetera, would basically call the U.S. government up and say, just by the way, we regard this as an act of your government. And so then effectively it would become the act of the government. If the U.S. government wanted to happen, that's fine, but then it really isn't the Koch brothers anymore. So I think the idea of a real rogue individual actor is pretty small. Let me give you some ideas about two different ways it could happen. If a really small state with a kind of evidently bad governance, Libya, started to do this, in a kind of haphazard way, I think the answer is the big states would stop them by threat of force very easily. Unless the big states really wanted to happen anyway. But if, say, India had a pretty open program, had an advisory board of elite scientists and ex-politicians and, you know, had a 10-year research program in a coherent way, said, we want to have an international agreement, we haven't got it, we're going to start doing this in a measured way to reduce the risks of crop failure for our Indian farmers, it would be extremely hard to stop. Because, in fact, a bunch of the other parts of the world, other countries, would actually secretly be kind of happy to have it happen and happy to have India take the liability. And India, if it did it on this scenario in a way that was kind of inherently credible, even though it wasn't actually authorized by a treaty, I think it would be very hard to stop. I think the risks come where, you know, and this is not wholly made up, this alters the monsoon flows, and maybe it actually makes the Chinese monsoon worse, or the Chinese just think it makes the Chinese monsoon worse. Either might be effective. Then this is an issue of national significance to the Chinese government, and how do those two countries solve this? They're nuclear-armed states. We don't have even, let alone have an international treaty, we don't even have a clear norm of how you resolve a question like that.
Over here.
But do you want to comment on that too?
Okay. If you look to, again, the category of small island nations that are actually on the edge of going out of business,
They
had a caucus. In fact, they've had caucuses at all of the major climate change meetings. And I actually met with them. When I was in Copenhagen, I just happened to be next to a bunch of guys from Vanuatu. And they were really upset. And they were talking about this as a matter of national survival, and they weren't joking about it. And if it's this cheap and this easy to do and it's a question of national survival, it's hard to actually argue moral authority in telling them not to. Well, you take Bangladesh. Yep. That cyclone a couple weeks ago that smacked India really hard could have hit the Delta. Mm-hmm. And as evidence comes in of connections, again, when you talk about retaliation, it could be entirely reasonable in the aftermath of terrible flooding for a country to say, we're going to start a program of experimentation on a small or medium scale and continue to ramp up. And again, I really do not regard unilateral action as something which is that improbable, if the results are as effective as you indicate. In fact, your book may ironically have made the probability of unilateral action higher. This is very convincing.
My name is Dan Sitso, and I'm a professor of atmospheric chemistry here at MIT. I have a question for David. This regards your closing statement, which was essentially benefits outweighing the risks, in your opinion. So there are a lot of risks to what you're proposing. You mentioned ozone loss, which is something that we saw after Pinatubo. There's a number of things that you didn't mention. For example, unabated acidification of the oceans, which would go on with CO2
rising. Why is that
rising.
A risk? I'm not understanding.
The oceans are acidifying because of increased CO2 in the atmosphere.
Right. So this isn't the problem putting CO2 in the atmosphere?
If you don't mind, I'm sure. going to try to finish the question.
That's a crucial one, because people always say it, and I think it's really morally confused.
We can go back to that. What I'm going to say is that there are a number of risks and side effects to what you're proposing. You mentioned the ozone problem that we did see after Pinatubo, something that has been seen. You mentioned air pollution problems with this sulfate that's going to come out. There's also a large degree of uncertainty in this problem as well. And what I mean by that is that I heard the terms come up of insurance and that you would use two jets, and this implies that there's some degree of certainty that if you do something, you're going to get a given effect out. But as was mentioned with cirrus clouds, this sulfate material has to go somewhere. It's going to interact with particles in the upper atmosphere. It's going to change clouds. It's going to change precipitation. None of these things are preserving the natural environment, which was something that you sort of alluded to as a reason to do this. So for me, this is not taboo. I mean, this is certainly something that we have talked about. But it is a non-starter, because for me, these side effects, the reduction of the ozone layer, the increase of skin cancer, acidification of the ocean, which we can talk about as being a CO2 consequence of something that you're not doing, for me are non-starters, because these are things that we should be tackling via the reduction of CO2 and eventual elimination of the CO2 that's in the atmosphere. So my question for you is, at what point does this become a non-starter for you? Is there an effect that you've considered, an uncertainty, one of the adverse effects, at which point you say this is not worth it, we have to go with the CO2 removal solution as opposed to doing something intentional to change the climate, like putting more aerosols into the upper atmosphere?
That's a really good question. I mean, I can wake up on different sides of the bed on this. I think there are arguments that the political risks are so big. I mean, I guess I would say that in some kind of magic world where rational humans sat around in a democratic way and made decisions, I think having the ability to do this as well as cutting emissions probably is a net benefit, because after all, that's kind of generically true, because the ability, you can still decide not to do it. I think in this world, it's quite possible that the right answer is not to do it and to make some kind of hard treaties that try and establish a principle of not doing it.
Over here.
Thank you. Hajir Rahmandad. I had a couple of more basic questions. So you mentioned a couple of the risks that you see. What are the kind of range of major risks that are known for now? Of course, there are unknown unknowns and the range of uncertainty around them. Secondly, if some actor decides to do this and doesn't announce it to the rest of the world, would the rest of the world know how detectable it is? Sure. And thirdly,
Those two are good.
Okay. So just what's the time constant for any intervention that you do in terms of putting the sulfuric acid to go away? You mentioned a couple of years for the basic chemistry, but is it longer for other impacts?
So in terms of risk, the risks depend on what you're doing. So for sulfuric acid, risks involve the fact anything you put in the stratosphere comes in a lower atmosphere. So it might cause, for example, the formation of cirrus clouds in ways you don't expect that could actually have the opposite radiative forcing sign. There's a bunch of us looking at that in various ways and thinking about how you'd actually go to observe it. There are ways that it could dramatically cut ozone, particularly in a wet stratosphere. That's something Jim Anderson and Deborah Weisenstein and I are looking at. There are ways it could affect ground-level air pollutants. That's the stuff that we're doing with Steve Barrett, trying to calculate the fatalities that would come from ground-level air pollution from adding these things, though that turns out to go in several directions when you start to do it. And so now we have big effects going in different directions that we don't even know what the sign is. There are all these larger questions about atmospheric circulation. So there are ways this changes the circulation of the stratosphere that might, for example, I mean, a very bad case would be that it makes it wetter. And there are some ways that you could imagine that happening. You could go on and on. There's a big list of these things. On the other hand, there's some ability to close the loop. if anybody is proposing that we just ramp up to a million tons a year without observing, then they're a nut. But there's lots of these kind of things that I said that you can actually watch for as you turn the knob up. And you have high signal to noise on those long before you have a climate effect. And that, I'm not talking to my hat on that. We've done numbers to look at that. For climate, this doesn't act as anti-CO2. So it's just not the same as reducing CO2. It turns out to be, according to all the current climate models have been run, and we've run the whole CMIP-5 ensemble now, much closer to anti-CO2 than a lot of us guessed. In terms of a regional basis, tending to pull both precip and temperature and other variables you measure back towards pre-industrial. But it certainly isn't, in that sense, perfect and never will be, theoretically imperfect. Could you do it in a way that is surreptitious? I think the answer is yes, not with sulfates, but there are other particles that you could imagine. So there's two ways. Could you do it where it was unknown which party was doing it? The answer to that is clearly yes. Now, I think if there was sort of sufficient kind of national technical means focused on finding it, you could probably find it once you knew it was there. But you could put sufficient materials, especially these advanced materials in the stratosphere, to alter the climate from a single airfield. So for sure you could do that surreptitiously. Right now we don't have as good monitoring of stratospheric radiative forcing as we should. We need more limb sounding instruments. And you could probably get away with putting in significant amounts of material before somebody knew it.
Over here.
Hi, I'm Santosh here, a student here. Isn't it possible that even if geoengineering is a necessary evil, and even if SRM is our best available technology at this point, it still may not be a valid option? What I'm saying is, shouldn't we not set the parameters for geoengineering in terms of moral, ethical, and political considerations first? And in the spirit of technology forcing, ask the geoengineering scientists to come back with a technology that meets those parameters, rather than see what we have right now and run with it and reason away the side effects?
That's another good question. I mean, one way to take it is to ask this. Dejama is asking me, could I conceive of saying no? I think this isn't so much for me a technical answer. I mean, obviously, if it technically turns out that the risks are really bigger than the benefits, then I trivially no. But I think there are reasons why you would say no, even if the direct benefits are pretty big. And those reasons have to do with some kind of political and social deal that deliberately forgoes this technology and refocuses on emissions control. And I think you can imagine agreements like that. It's a stretch that kind of pushes it out. I mean, you can't forgo something to the infinite future. It's a meaningless, you can claim you are, but it doesn't mean anything. But you could imagine some kind of political deal to renew efforts on emission control that essentially puts a moratoria on doing this for a long time. And I think that's one of the different ways you could couple the two together that people are exploring. One thing I try to spend some time saying in the book is people often argue that think about this as science and have this ethic of science that we're just going to go discover stuff and that scientific freedom should be the issue. And I actually think that's inappropriate. I think this is a technological question. We're trying to, you know, develop a technology here, essentially. And this isn't a matter of pure science. When you develop a technology, you have a goal in mind, and an implicit goal in the technology developer's head. And I think that's where, you know, social input is really needed, because the particular atmospheric scientists or people like me, our goals are no better than anybody else's. We need to have a real social conversation about essentially what we're asking this technology's sort of high-level characteristics to be. And that's true in terms of sort of its controllability.
I see a question back here.
Yeah, hi. So my name is Christoph Sachs, and actually I work on like the next generation solar cells, and of course like listening to you scares me really. But one thing I want to say, I think your argument is a little bit flawed from my point of view, because if I think climate change as a disease, I have many symptoms, and you're really focusing on the temperature. Actually, I really think that he had a good argument that there are so many other side effects. And this is like if I would have cancer and you give me a painkiller, I would feel great, right? But I would eventually die, right? And I think you're just sort of postponing the real problems into the future, and it's really like a Band-Aid.
Yeah. That's typically what technology fixes have been since the invention of agriculture.
Yeah, and I think really you give people basically the ability to cut really like funding for other resources because there is no motivation. You know what I mean? This is what you're doing.
Yeah, but the problem is you've got to think about how you make that argument and make it stick and have it not stick to all sorts of other technologies that are partially life-saving and introduce problems. All the technologies that help to feed, like Haber processed nitrogen that helps us to feed a population this big, each of these technologies are responses to problems introduced by previous technologies. That's what technology is. And each of them introduces social responses that cause further problems. That is what technology does. It's a fractal thing where each thing builds on the last thing's problems. And I'm not claiming that that means we should necessarily do this, but I don't think you can claim that just because it has this band-aid quantity, which it certainly does, that sort of magically means we shouldn't do that. Because if you look around you, this room, I could enumerate, I've done this in classes, all these things that are in some ways band-aids, fixes for some previous problem or some other technology.
I don't think that what you're saying is correct. It's at the end of the day, it's maybe a question of philosophy, where you come from, what are your fundamentals of how you think about that? And I think there we have a fundamental disagreement.
Could be. I'll just for a second say, in a technical sense, we both, by the way, don't just think about temperature, so we think a lot about precipitation and soil moisture and air pollutants, and so I think it's a multidimensional thing. And to be clear, the people thinking about solar geoengineering are thinking about more than just temperature. But it still is a band-aid.
I'd like to thank David and Ken for great presentations, and thank you all for your wonderful questions.
That was the conclusion of A Case for Climate Engineering, a discussion with author and Harvard climate scientist David Keith. In his October 2013 book published at MIT, he makes the case that global warming and CO2 pollution have become so severe that dramatic measures have to be researched immediately and applied by 2020. His method of choice is spraying sulfuric acid from airplanes. Thanks to the Boston Review for the video of this discussion that was recorded on October 30th, 2013. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. You can get information on how to order a 1-hour CD at cost on tucradio.org or by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. TUC Radio's mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. That's Calpella, California, 95418. For more information, go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.